Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
The crack of dawn to send a little money home from here to the moon is rising like a discotheque, and now my bags are down and packed for traveling, looking at happiness, keeping my flavor fresh. Nobody knows, I guess, how far I'll go.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We begin with David Byrne in the background, the lead track to his 2005 release, Grown Backwards. David Byrne is a singer, songwriter, filmmaker, and visual artist who's been called, quote, perhaps the single greatest influence on the current generation of indie rockers, unquote. He's also apparently a sucker for a great pair of shoes. Later this week, he is presenting a Perspectives series at Carnegie Hall, and his own concert chronicles the life of Imelda Marcos, former First Lady of the Philippines and infamous shoe nut. We went to David Byrne's studio in downtown Manhattan last week, and we started by asking him, why Imelda Marcos?
I was really initially interested in people in power, what drives them, and the kind of artificial bubble that they tend to live in. And when I saw a few years ago that she used to go to Studio 54 and she had a disco built in her New York townhouse and converted the roof of the Manila Palace into a disco, I thought, here's a person of power that kind of comes with their own soundtrack. They're already identified with a particular kind of musical approach, at least. And I thought, well, I can maybe then dance music might be the way to tell this story.
So is it a song cycle? Is it an opera of some kind?
At present, it's a song cycle. I think that eventually it'll be more. There's more elements than that, but that's what it is right now, and it's all kind of, it does tell a story.
And you're collaborating with Fatboy Slim.
Yes. It's dance music, as it's called, and I got in touch with Fatboy Slim and said, hey, I have this idea. And I'd never met him before. And he said he was up for it. So we started by exchanging things by mail, mm-hmm. more or less. And then I made a few trips over to Brighton, where he works.
And so what is his contribution? Is he sampling old disco tracks or something?
I don't ask him where he gets some of his samples. That's that's his business.
Plausible deniability, huh?
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, he contributes beats and kind of arrangement things, but usually created very often by manipulating beats and editing and that kind of thing.
Well, this is all part, I mean, Here Lies Love is part of this four-concert series in the Perspectives at Carnegie Hall, which begins on Thursday, runs through Sunday. Now, you know, Carnegie Hall does this each year, and they pick, you know, artists like Dawn Upshaw, Caetano Veloso, and it's really a chance for you to kind of show people what you've been thinking about musically and where you see yourself coming from, maybe where you see yourself going. It's funny, given the recent New York Times article where, in fact, they talked about all this generation of indie rock bands that look to you for inspiration. Interesting to see some of the choices that you've made, which I think would surprise people who expected to see Arcade Fire or Franz Ferdinand or bands like that represented.
Those bands are great, but to be honest, they might not sound that good in Carnegie Hall. It has acoustics. It's very live, and so it sounds good for certain kinds of music, and for, well, sometimes for very amplified music, it just doesn't work.
Well, now you've played, I mean, you were on Caetano's Perspective series, right?
Yes, and we played an acoustic set, and I think it went pretty well.
Yeah.
And for some of my own things, there's electric instruments, but we're going to kind of keep it on the low side. Otherwise, there's problems with the sound in the room. It's a great sounding room, but for certain things. So for one evening, I got in touch with a lot of kind of contemporary, well, I guess, folk musicians, or they might not like being called that, but they kind of fall under that category. Devendra Bandhart and Coco Rosie and Vetiver, a British guy named Adam, and a Brazilian woman named Cibele, and one of their antecedents, a woman named Vashti Bunyan.
Right. And people are referring to what she did and now what Devendra Bandhart and people like that do as freak folk or psych folk, because it has this kind of psychedelic cast to it, I suppose, a certain chilly, at times almost creepy, menacing aspect.
I don't know if they would agree with that.
Yeah.
But it certainly has, there's a kind of a looseness and a kind of openness of approach where they'll kind of mess with the sounds and add all sorts of instruments, and they're not following any kind of dogma as far as music goes.
So Vashti Bunyan, I mean, we can hear a little bit of her music. What's do you see her as kind of the talking heads to Devendra Bandhart's Franz Ferdinand or Arcade Fire? I mean, is she the one that...
To some extent, yeah, you might say that. She and probably some others. I would say she and there was a group called the Incredible String Band and a few others, I think, that took acoustic music into some interesting places.
Right. Well, here's a little bit of music from Vashti Bunyan, who is part of the Perspective series that David Byrne is curating this week, later this week, at Carnegie Hall.
Just another diamond day, just a blade of grass, just another pair of hay, and the horses pass. La 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 la. A sack of seed to sow, and the children eat. La 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 la.
A little bit of music from Vashti Bunyan, who is part of a program called Welcome to Dreamland that David Byrne is curating. Also features Devendra Bandhart and Cibele, Coco Rosie, and others in the style that's come to be known as psych folk or freak folk. Artist David never liked being put in little boxes like that, but in this particular little box there's a second generation removed from Vashti Bunyan that you've selected. A band like Coco Rosie has a very kind of charming lo-fi, very friendly sort of sound. How do you see that as kind of fitting into the, you know, what's out there? And I mean, it seems like the music that's getting a lot of interest from the general public these days is very slick. We like highly produced things. Was there something here that really kind of spoke to you?
Well, I think they and a lot of the other groups on that program have kind of, I think some of their music is a kind of counter-reaction or a reaction to the kind of over-slickness of a lot of music that's out there, or over-produced things and things that sound a little too perfect. I think they probably feel, I'm putting words in their mouth, but I think they probably feel that some of the honesty and kind of direct from the heart and the kind of spontaneity has been taken out of the music. And I think they feel like, okay, if we strip away some of that, and let the music be heard kind of warts and all, then it might be a more kind of honest presentation of what we're feeling.
Well, having just heard a little bit of Vashti Bunyan, if we listen to a little bit of Coco Rosie right now, I think we can kind of hear, whatever differences there are in sound, a kind of similarity maybe in approach. Bit of music there from the band Coco Rosie. David Byrne is my guest on Soundcheck today, and we are looking ahead to this week's Perspective series at Carnegie Hall, which is Thursday through Sunday, February 1st through 4th. David, we mentioned your new song cycle, Here Lies Love, this Dreamland project, you know, the so-called psych folk people. There's also a performance of your knee plays, your brass band pieces from the mid-80s. And what am I missing? There's the one note concert.
An evening called One Note, which is a little bit hard to describe. Maybe hard for a non-musician. Because musically, I think it might not be obvious to a non-musician that there's a kind of similarity between these three very different kinds of groups on that evening. There's a French singer named Camille, an Iranian singer, Holly, who works here, and a kind of chamber orchestra called Alarm Will Sound that kind of works out of the New York area as well.
Right.
And they're all, musically, they're miles apart, all of them, but they all have in common that their music has as its central axis, I guess, in many of their pieces, a single note. Or a continuous note. And sometimes it's heard, sometimes it's implied, but that's kind of structurally what a lot of the music they're playing is about. And so the music might sound wildly different one thing from another, but I think it'll be interesting to see if that structural similarity becomes apparent when you put them next to one another.
Well, let's back out a little bit and talk about these four apparently dissimilar concerts. Is there the same kind of thought behind them? Or is there something that you're hoping people who go to all four events will see as a connecting thread?
Ooh, not that I'm aware. I felt like I took a fairly pragmatic approach, choosing things that would sound good in the rooms that they were going to be performed in, so that over the four nights there's not a big similarity between one night and another, but maybe that's part of the point as well.
Okay.
The fact that there's a kind of it's very diverse.
Mm-hmm. One of the other evenings is devoted to the knee plays, which they're brass band pieces that you did in the mid 80s. And which you said at the time were inspired by the Dirty Dozen Brass Band of New Orleans. And it seems to have been a post-Katrina concert that really kind of kick-started this whole resurrection of these pieces.
Exactly. One of the many post-Katrina benefits that was held here in the city, there was one at Town Hall, and I participated in it, and I thought, what better kind of thing to perform as maybe a few of these brass band pieces, because they were inspired by music that came out of New Orleans. They don't really have the same kind of swing and sensibility as the Dirty Dozen Brass Band and the other brass bands that inspired them. Sometimes they're very stiff, intentionally so, and sometimes they do swing a bit. But that was the initial inspiration. And so I did a few of them there, and I thought, wow, why not do the whole set?
And so that will be one of the Perspectives concerts. The term knee plays, this is a term that Robert Wilson coined for his various huge opera and theater productions. Mm-hmm. They're connecting joints between the larger portions of his works.
Exactly. Knee means refers to a joint.
Now, did you see the knee plays, these connecting joints, as it were, did you see them when taken out of context and put together, as they were back in the late 80s, as a story or as a piece unto themselves?
Yeah, Bob Wilson saw it that way. He always thought that they would be like little chapters, and you could put them all together with the appropriate dramatic action, mm-hmm. and they would tell some kind of story. But saying that something tells a story in a Bob Wilson piece is kind of, well, okay, story in the very loosest sense.
Right, right. The noted American theater director has a very elusive approach to narrative.
Yes.
As does my guest David Byrne sometimes, and we'll hear an example of that in this excerpt from the Knee Plays, which is a song called In the Future.
In the future, everyone will have the same haircut and the same clothes. In the future, everyone will be very fat from the starchy diet. In the future, everyone will be very thin from not having enough to eat. In the future, it will be next to impossible to tell girls from boys, even in bed. In the future, men will be super masculine and women will be ultra feminine. In the future, half of us will be mentally ill. In the future, there will be no religion or spiritualism of any sort. In the future, the psychic arts will be put to practical use. In the future, we will not think that nature is beautiful. In the future, the weather will always be the same. In the future, no one will fight with anyone else. In the future, there will be an atomic war. In the future, water will be expensive. In the future, all material items will be free. In the future, everyone's house will be a little fortress. In the future, everyone's house will be a total entertainment center.
An excerpt from David Byrne's Knee Plays, part of his Perspective series at Carnegie Hall, and in a moment we continue our conversation as David Byrne tells us about where he stands in the battle for copyright in the digital age. You're listening to Soundcheck.
In the future, everyone but the wealthy will be very happy. In the future, everyone but the wealthy will be very filthy. In the future, everyone but the wealthy will be very healthy. In the future, TV will be so good that the printed word will function as an art form only.
Burning down the house!
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Still to come, Bob Dylan's Basement Tapes, an iconic album, but Howard Fishman will tell us about his new look, this old favorite. Right now, we continue our interview with David Byrne in his downtown Manhattan offices, where we went last week. We started the second part of our interview by asking him about his upcoming concert series at Carnegie Hall and whether he was actually trying to balance the old and the new.
I did have a sense that, as part of it, when you're invited to do one of these things, you're expected to do at least one night yourself. And I thought, well, this is, I'm not going to get up and just perform my old stuff. I'm going to take this as an opportunity. And I thought it's really generous in a way of Carnegie Hall to be unafraid of letting me, say, present an evening of completely new stuff that nobody's heard before, which is something that Well, I think musicians often would love to do, but kind of their practical natures and the audience kind of usually demands, no, you've got to play some favorites for us.
So how do you deal with that? I mean, you know, you have a body of work with Talking Heads that people still, every time you take a stage anywhere, there's a certain percentage, probably a pretty large percentage of the people in the audience who are expecting to hear Psycho Killer and, you know, all their favorite Talking Head songs.
Well, I play those fairly often now. For a while I didn't, but now I incorporate a pretty nice selection of that stuff into most performances I do. But because this is a kind of song cycle and it tells a story, that stuff really doesn't have a place in it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that you've done not only music, but, you know, you've done visual art and film, and but you have done a lot of online, you know, lots of different things with the various online media. Do you worry about, you know, becoming expert in one medium before you move on to another, or is part of the thrill just going out there and being an amateur in many different things?
There's a nice feeling as when you kind of develop a little bit of a skill in some area. I mean, I know certain kind of tricks of the trade in writing a song. I think I've learned some of those things, so I know how to do it, but that's also a danger that you'll fall back on those and just use a lot of the kind of tricks that you know will work, kind of technical tricks and lyrical tricks and this kind of thing, and that you'll, therefore, you won't really kind of push yourself to write something, the implication being it won't really be from the heart because it's too easy if you, once you get good at something. So the result is that sometimes you kind of jump into an area that you're a little less familiar with, because then you really have to pay attention. Mm-hmm. You have to pay attention to what you're doing, and really look at it and see if it's working, and even if you're not a virtuoso in that area, it can be about what it is you're trying to communicate and not about kind of a demonstration of skill.
Right. Now, last year in May, you collaborated with Creative Commons in the reissue of your landmark recording with Brian Eno, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. I know that, you know, copyright, I mean, intellectual copyright and property law and stuff has become a big issue in the digital world, and seems to be for you too.
There's a lot of confusion, I think. Things have been changing and developing so quickly that there's a lot of confusion out there. People, for one thing, they confuse downloading with file sharing.
Right.
In the world of downloading and file sharing, there is some overlap. In order, when you engage in file sharing, you often download the file, but they're not necessarily exactly the same, which I think, so, less so now, but I think a few years ago, that meant that record companies were completely afraid of the idea of downloading music online. So they completely stay shied away from developing online sales of music because they confused it with
illegal
Napster
file.
And other things that they didn't like. And I think in some sense the same thing is happening with Creative Commons. In the industry, in the music industry, when you mention Creative Commons, the first reaction is, oh, those are the people that just want us to give up all music rights and all copyrights. And I thought, well, I guess you haven't read any of their rights. Because there's kind of a spectrum of Creative Commons agreements. Some of them do allow a really broad use of the material. Others are much more restrictive, and in some cases they're more restrictive in certain ways than the existing kind of copyright laws.
Well, what was your arrangement with Creative Commons for the Bush of Ghosts reissue?
It was, we made the individual tracks of a few of the songs available for download for free, and that people could then remix them and play with them or examine them or do whatever they wanted with them at will.
Just to clarify, when you say the tracks, you mean like the guitar track, the bass track,
exactly,
the drum track of those two songs, I think it was.
Yeah. So in some cases that meant a lot of material being downloaded, but because sometimes there might be 24 different instruments or tracks that made up the finished song. That doesn't mean, for example, that you, once you downloaded all 24 tracks, that you could instantly recreate the finished song. In mixing a song, balancing it, and deciding which instruments play when, in a sense, that's part of the creativity and the creation of the finished recording. So in a sense, we still weren't giving that away.
Right.
But we're giving away all the component parts, and we were doing it under what I think is one of the fairly common Creative Commons licenses, which says that the person who downloads it can basically do whatever they want, but they can't use it for profit.
So I can't download the tracks for your songs, do my own mix, and then release a record and, you know, sell tens of thousands of copies.
Yes, or if you want to, you have to make an arrangement with us, which we haven't said we would never do, but and that to us, to Brian and I, seemed very fair.
Yeah.
Because it allows, in the spirit of Creative Commons, it allows people to investigate, to see how something was made, to have materials that they can use creatively in their own work. They may use some of those tracks in their own work, and then they may abandon them, which is what I do sometimes when I'm writing. Mm. I'll kind of grab a sample from somebody else's song, work over that, and then take it away once the structure has been built around it, and I no longer need that framework.
Well, the framework of many of the songs in my life of Bush of Ghosts was just that. It was found material from other records, from off the radio. Let's hear an example from David Byrne and Brian Eno in the 2006 reissue of My Life in the Bush of Ghosts.
America is waiting for a message of some sort or another.
David Byrne and Brian Eno, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, 1979, 1980, you and Brian did this. It was kind of a watershed moment, lots of found sounds. We're speaking with David Byrne, of course, on Soundcheck. The 2006 reissue done in conjunction with Creative Commons. What do you think is the big benefit of doing things with them, with putting music or at least musical materials out there for anybody to use?
In the creative community, it's I think, very similar to the scientific community. If you don't share a certain amount of knowledge and make it available in a kind of common library, you kind of stop. You kind of put a basically a wall as far as research and development and creativity goes. Nothing is built on nothing. Everything is built on top of kind of the work of people who went before you. And if you're not allowed to see what they did and how they worked and mm-hmm. look at their notes and how they put things together, and then
becomes a dead end.
It becomes a dead end. The research basically stops in that area.
So do you worry about your own intellectual copyright, you know, your intellectual properties, the songbook that you've amassed over the decades?
Yeah, at present, I certainly don't worry about it. Yeah. And the way that my understanding is that the way the copyright law was originally conceived, way back, I don't know, 100 years ago or more, was that it protects the creator and gives the creator an incentive, a monetary incentive, to make some money off their work. And it continues for a certain number of years, but it's not this basically almost limitless thing that can be passed on from generation to generation or company to company or whatever. So it gives the creator incentive, but then it gets released at some point. Mm. It gets released and becomes public work. I think most of the classical music that's performed is to some extent in the public domain, that you pay for, I think, the music, and you pay some kind of licensing.
Right. Although I just learned recently that shape note hymns, you know, the American singing of the South and mm-hmm. New England, mid-18th century, that the shapes of the shape notes were copywritten.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody copywrote those triangles and diamonds uh-huh. and squares. I mean, uh-huh. easy tool to use, uh-huh. but copywritten. And who knew? Anyway, David, the Perspective series later this week, Thursday through Sunday, I mean, is it a kind of a reflection of the David Byrne who's out almost every night? I mean, people see you all the time out in the clubs and, and concerts and stuff.
I didn't go out last night. But, and I think the Perspective series, yes, is in a way, it's maybe a reflection of maybe some wide listening habits. If anything.
Well, they're four very disparate events, and the details are all on the Soundcheck page of our website at WNYC.org. We've been speaking with the singer and songwriter David Byrne. And David, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for having us here in your place.
Thanks for coming
afternoon.
Here. That's really nice.
He even does opera, an excerpt from Bizet's Pearl Fishers, David Byrne with Rufus Wainwright. And this is Soundcheck. Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Thanks.